Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Freedom!
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here, Money, Riches, and Wealth. And I come back and the show's still here, Tom. You guys obviously did a great job last week with me out.
Well, we did fine, but we're thankful you're back.
I hear you had a great show, though. I'm looking forward to listening to the tape, you know?
Yep.
And you had Chris's birthday last week and everything, right?
We did, and we celebrated more today.
Yeah, so. We did indeed. Anyway, I have plenty of things I could talk about on a Drew's View, but I really want to get right to our guest tonight. So
definitely.
Why don't you tell us who we're speaking to tonight? Because I think this is probably one of the most important topics that you can talk about financially.
Yeah, that'd be great. We have with us on the line Gene Sturley, and Gene is the Fisher Chair at the Urban Institute, author of a column and blog called The Government We Deserve. So for those bloggers, it's blog.governmentwedeserve.org. And his latest book, which we're going to talk about tonight, Dead Men Ruling, is going to be an interesting topic. You can reach Gene at E, as in Eugene, E. Sturley, S-T-E-U-E-R-L-E, at urban.org. And you're going to want to do that after you hear from him, because he's got quite a background. In addition to, you know, being the chair at the Urban Institute, he has been the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for tax analysis back in the late 80s, President of the National Tax Association, Chair of the Technical Panel Advising Social Security on its methods and assumptions. And then also, I thought this was interesting, he was the original organizer of the 1984 Treasury study that led to the Tax Reform Act of 1986. And Lord knows we need more reforms.
That's true. Anyway... Hey, Gene, are you there with us?
Sure am. Looking forward to this, Drew.
Gene, we really appreciate you being here. And the way I came to know Gene was from the former IRS commissioner appointed under the Reagan administration. And I think he served under both Reagan and Bush, didn't he?
That's right. Larry Gibbs was one of the finest gentlemen civil servants I've known for a long time, so I was honored to have him recommend me.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first saw the title of your book, Dead Men Ruling, I thought you were insulting these guys down in Washington. I thought you were calling them a bunch of dead men. But after I read the book, I realized that that's not exactly what you were saying. Maybe you implied it, but I don't think that's exactly what you were saying.
No, the title, Dead Men Ruling, is actually trying to appeal to them, to say to them, you've lost all control over this budget because essentially almost everything we do within the budget on the tax and the spending side has been put into the law by past legislators, largely dead men. There were a few women, but I wasn't being sexist in the title. They were mainly men.
Right. So, yeah, you know, FDR had a big part in it. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan. I mean, you might, whether you like any of them or not, they all had a part of it, whether it was Democrat or Republican. These things are still going on today. And the current legislators, you say, only influence, what did you say, 20%, if that, of what's happening?
If that, and a great deal of that 20% might come out of, depends on how you even define it, might come out of just deficit spending. So one of the really interesting facts that I point out in the book is that in 2009, for the first time in United States history, every single dollar of revenue had been committed before Congress walked in the door. So, now of course they ran big deficits then, so those deficits, so we did spend more than just the amount of revenues we collected, but it was all financed out of a deficit. And that figure comes by basically just subtracting the automatic, what are called mandatory or entitlement programs and interest on the debt, and just seeing what share of revenues they take up and seeing what's just left for discretionary spending. And it's a neutral index, I should be very clear. It's neither appealing to conservatives or liberals. It's basically saying that you both can reduce the flexibility of the budget. You can reduce it if you have tax cuts that you don't pay for with spending cuts. which just defers those taxes to the future. Or you could do it by having automatic growth in spending programs that occurs without new legislation at all. So if there's a problem to be had from losing control over the budget, it's on both sides of the aisle.
So in other words, what you're saying here is that when dead men are ruling, in other words, it's not just, you know, FDR put in Social Security and people tweaked it for political purposes, that it's absorbing a large part of the budget, or Medicare, but it's also people who decide that they're going to cut taxes and raise the deficit, which then creates that we have to pay this interest that's spending part of our income we're receiving every year before the new guys ever get into office.
That's right, that's right. And, you know, the FDR story is a really interesting one, too. There's a little table in the back of the book by which I rank presidents by who presided over the most growth in domestic spending. Now, this is measured from the end of their term, from the beginning. And it turns out that FDR and Harry Truman together had a domestic spending budget that was smaller as a share of the economy 20 years later, that is in 1952-53 when they left, than it was in 1932 when they came into the office. And you might say, well, that goes against my whole notion about bigger government under FDR. Well, there was bigger government. It largely came about partly from the Depression, but largely from the war and the tax rates that we increased then and never have retreated from. But if you look at domestic spending, most of the domestic spending in the Depression, whether it was spent well or not, it's one question, but it went away when people got employed because it was mainly directed at employment. And yes, Social Security was the first of these major entitlement or mandatory programs, but it was not even then scheduled to grow forever faster in the economy, which we've added later in the system. It was scheduled to grow while it matured, but we added since then all these ways in which as we get richer, we would just still let the system get bigger and bigger. So,
well, that may be.
It's a really interesting FDR story. At least most of the spending was directed at solving a problem. If the problem was solved, it went away. Think of our healthcare and retirement systems. They're just scheduled to grow forever faster than the economy without regard to any objective that you might set out.
But that, yes, but that's the exact point, though, Gene, and that is that FDR may have had those statistics that we can point to, but he started a program that then created a political football that people could add on to, like Richard Nixon did, like Lyndon Johnson did, like George Bush did, you know, and so forth, as they just kept coming in and say, hey, let's do this, we can do that. And Ronald Reagan did the same. I think what he did was very important for tax cutting, but then it created a political football that they come in later and say, hey, let's cut taxes. You know, look what it did for Ronald Reagan. So,
that's right. I mean, the book is not meant to take huge sides on big mistakes we made in the past. Basically, it's our arguing that the objectives of liberals in the last half of the 20th century was to create a social welfare state that provided protections, and I think they largely succeeded. And the goal of conservatives, at least in the budget side of things, was basically to try to reduce the very high tax rates we had, and they largely succeeded. And I'm saying we don't need to continue 20th century agendas. We don't need to build up existing social welfare programs if they're already doing their job and just make them get bigger and bigger. We don't necessarily need to cut marginal tax rates if we got them down to a reasonable level. I'm not saying those aren't worthwhile objectives, but there's a lot of other things we could be doing as a nation. And we could do it, I think, with a fairly lean government.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. But what we have to do right now is we have to find out what's going on with traffic out there before we solve the problems of our country, Gene. So you're going to have to hold on with me, and we're going to go to Maggie Hunter in traffic, and we're going to come right back with Gene Sterley about dead men ruling. Take it away, Maggie.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Now, what's the purpose of that song, Noah? Oh, okay. Well, it's an interesting song, but it, you know. Anyway, don't forget what we were going to put on later this, right? Yeah, man. Okay. Right. Anyway, we're here with Gene Sterley, and we're talking about Dead Men Rolling. And Gene, I would consider him one of the foremost experts on the budget in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's one area that he has studied, you know, mentally. And Gene, you know, in your book, you show a graph that everyone knows, all the politicians have seen it, that our debt to GDP in our country, if we do nothing, our debt to GDP is just going to continue to rise to 250% debt to GDP over the next 20 years or so, right?
Right. It keeps rising because we have these built-in growth and programs, and we're neither willing to slow down the growth in these programs, nor are we willing to collect the taxes necessary to pay the bills. So a huge amount of that, especially when you get way out in the future, is just the effect, I'm sure you talk about a lot on your show, of compound interest, right?
Sure.
Compounding debt and the interest payments on those debt enough, and then the thing just explodes. By the way, I have that in the book, but I don't spend a lot of time on that because I actually think, you know, through hook or crook and monetary policy and recessions and all those sorts of things, you know, I'm not so sure the whole thing is going to explode. My problem is being on that path causes us to really keep a very bad set of government policies in place and really doesn't enable us to really create a government that I think really is more one that invests in our future. I think our budget is largely one that's very consumption-oriented, often for legitimate reasons, but it's really pushing against the investment side.
Well, like you say in the book, that our policies that are going into place today are done by people who are dealing with problems from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s or whatever, and it largely, you stated in the book here, it was largely political agendas to help the elderly.
Right, and healthcare, which at least initially was for the elderly. But let's take that elderly budget, because it's often thought about that this is sometimes that part of this statement is that I'm all for tax increases or I'm all for cuts in an elderly budget. What I'm really for is the flexibility in the budget to do the things we need to do. So, for instance, with elderly policy, I would actually strengthen what we do for low-income elderly. I don't think we do enough. I would actually try to do a lot to make it much easier for the elderly to work. I think for the near elderly or to the first half of the 21st century, what I think women were for the last half of the 20th century, the largest pool of underutilized talent we have in this economy. I would make it a lot easier for people to engage in partial retirement. So I would do a lot there for them. On the other hand, now that an average couple gets about, on average, if they retire at 62, they're expected to get close to three decades, about 27, 28 years of retirement benefits. I don't know that we need to keep those numbers going up.
That's because when Social Security was first created, you retired at 65 and your life expectancy was 70 to 75.
Well, 70 to 75 is more at birth, but your life expectancy was about 6 years less than it was now. On top of that, people started retiring earlier, so they both retired earlier, and they started living longer, so that in total, people get about 11 more years of benefits today than when Social Security was first established.
Now, whatever happened to our trust fund? Nobody ever seems to talk about that anymore with Social Security.
Well, the trust fund can be misleading. The trust fund built up moderately, and I say moderately, it never was able to cover more than, say, 10% of the total debt of the system. It was basically established as sort of a reserve, so when we went through bad times, we could work our way through the cycle. But what happened when the baby boomers came along and filled up the workforce, temporarily, mind you, it started collecting a bit more revenues than it paid out in benefits. But now it's paying out more benefits than it collects in revenues. And the only way it's able to make up the difference is to take general revenues. Now, some of those general revenues provide a little interest on those bonds that were there when the baby boomers were working. But in some ways, it doesn't really matter a lot, because you go out to 2030 or so, and the trust funds are gone, 2033. The Social Security trust fund is gone. And you're paying out, by current benefit formulas, you're paying out maybe a third more than you're collecting in revenues. And that happens whether you're a real big trust fund advocate or you're not. And so sometimes the trust fund story just doesn't, it doesn't help explain a lot. That's part of its problem. It was a useful tool, but it was never like a private trust fund. It wasn't a buildup of assets to pay off debt in the future. It was just a modest, very modest buildup of money from the time the baby boomers were fully in the workforce.
So, you know, all the politicians, they all go out on the campaign trail and they say this to you, Gene, I'm a conservative, I'm going to cut taxes for you. And the liberals come out and say, Gene, if you're a liberal, I'm going to raise this and I'm going to raise that. But what you're saying in this book is they really have no ability to do anything because these dead men who put all these policies in place 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago are enacting most of their decisions at, you know, when they walk into office.
Right. So the way we report on the budget and the way it's fought out, maybe even some people on your show, you know, the way it's often fought out is who are the winners and who are the losers. But that's measured not to the current levels of what government does. It's measured to what's built into the law. So if I want to favor, you know, subsidies for tsetse fly importation, and I've got them in the law, and they're supposed to grow at 10% a year, and you cut me back to 9% a year, I scream and holler that, oh, my baseline's been cut. You've cut my benefit, when in fact it's actually growing. I just, legislatively you cut it, but it's relative to this baseline. So the political game that's played in this town of Washington, D.C., where I'm sitting right now, is define my baseline. If I really want growth in my subsidies, I want them to be built in as fast as I can. If I want to cut taxes, I want taxes to be as low as I can, so then I can attack the other side if they do anything to get the budget in order, either by slowing that growth rate or by increasing those taxes. So, but defining that baseline, which sounds like a narrow technical issue, gets played out in the press and the media and a lot of other places in who's a winner and who's a loser. And in strange ways, so if you cut the Medicare budget from, say, 4% growth to 3%, that's called a cut. If you increase the education budget, which doesn't have built-in growth, and which I would view as the more investment side of the budget, if you increase that from 0% to 1%, that's called an increase. Well, that's not a consistent way to look at these programs and make choices. I'm not saying, I mean, your listeners are going to have widely divergent views on what they would like to do as the economy gets richer, as we get richer. Some would want to cut taxes. Some would want to expand some elderly programs. Some, like myself, would want to spend more on education. But the system doesn't give us a level playing field for making those choices. And in some sense, it's because the policymakers have gone so far, no longer battling over what to do with current resources they have on hand, but how to control those future resources before somebody else does.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, that I struggle with, and, you know, I don't study it like you do, but, you know, I look at Washington and I say, these guys are probably the most inefficient, wasteful people I've ever seen in my entire life. How do I get over that?
Well,
or do I?
So let me say something in terms of their favorite. Now, maybe this goes too far, but part of the problem, this system that I'm talking about, this where dead men rule, has been built up over several decades. And the policy, the elected officials are really in what in technically is called a prisoner's dilemma, but I'll define it simply. It's if you lead, you lose. And what do I mean by that? Well, to the conservatives, if you go back to the mid-60s or even the 70s, they basically viewed themselves as this oppressed minority. In the mid-60s, they had one president since 1932, and that was Dwight Eisenhower, and some of them didn't want to count him. And they had only had the House of Representatives for something like 2 years. And they kept questioning why they were this minority. There was a guy by the name of Jude Winitsky, who was an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal, who argued, well, you're on the losing side of this budget because you're Scrooge, and the Democrats get to be Santa Claus. And I think there was some truth to that. And then, by trying to get the budget in order, they paid a political price. Now, Democrats have their own stories. When Bill Clinton did do a budget agreement in 93, he lost the House of Representatives the next year for the first time, in several decades. There's also a view among Democrats that they got the budget in order in the 90s. It's an exaggerated view because there was a lot of things that happened. You probably covered on your show, like this big stock market bubble that occurred at the end of the 90s. that really made things look better than they were. But still, that was their view. They viewed the efforts they did make, the political efforts they made, as just financing George Bush's tax cuts. And I go on and on. In the last presidential campaign, both candidates, Governor Romney and President Obama, attacked the other because they were going to cut back on Medicare. Now, they were going to do it for other reasons, but they both were actually going to do it. They both were going to cut that growth rate. President Obama was going to do it partly because that's how he partly paid for Obamacare. And Governor Romney did that because he proposed moving, or at least supported the movement towards voucherizing or having some more fixed level of payment that goes to people to buy insurance policies, such as Paul Ryan has suggested. And both of them would have cut back on Medicare. But what did they do? They said, well, you know, I don't like what you're doing with the money, but you're right, that system has to be under control. No, they didn't do that. They attacked the others. Oh, you're taking this money away from the elderly. You know, as if this 4% or whatever 5% growth rate was ever sustainable.
Right.
So they were playing to this theme. If you lead in trying to get anything under control, you lose.
And if you're Santa Claus, you win.
We punish them. We voters punish them.
If you're Santa Claus, you win. If you're Scrooge, you lose. Right. That's what you're saying.
Right. And traditionally, now think back historically, when the budget's discretionary, revenues rise with the economy. So if a president is in for 8 years and the economy grows by 30%, revenues, whether it's a tariff or an income tax, revenues would rise by about 30%. If money's discretionary, that means there's a lot of revenues to spend in the future that's not committed. Right?
Right. I see what you're saying.
The economy's growing. Discretionary spending isn't growing. It's probably declining. You've already built the post office, so you've already built the road or whatever you're spending your money on.
So you
could have a profligate Congress, but there's a year-to-year decision. You just got to not do it year after year. It's not built into the system. Now it's built into the system. And so these policymakers, their job is to come to you and me and tell us what promise they're going to renege on. Are they going to renege on this promise for this unsustainable growth? Are they going to renege on this promise for taxes that aren't adequate to pay the debt? Or to even pay our bills as we go along? What promise do they want to renege on?
You got to hold on with me.
Right.
I got to take this break on traffic, but it's great. And we're going to get right back to find out what do we do about this now with Gene Sterley, Dead Men Rolling. Take it away, Maggie.
And you never know who's going to hear the call. Every game does a different start. That's the magic of a real baseball.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBS.
We did that for you, Tom.
I really appreciate that.
Being a Yankee fan, you know. And I don't know about you, Gene. Are you a National fan or an Oriole? Or do you have some other city?
Well, actually, I'm very fond of both of them. So I probably
you should be a politician, Gene.
I know, but more National fan than a Baltimore fan. I hope we can meet in the playoffs.
Well, there you go. I mean, you guys clinched the division, too. So you guys, congratulations on the pennant. I don't know what the National song is. Maybe Noah can get that for the next break.
Maybe Noah can get that for the next break and so forth. Go ahead, Thomas.
A lot of pressure, yeah. So, Gene, thanks for being with us. And once again, everybody, we have Gene Sterley with us, author of Dead Men Ruling. And he also has a blog, The Government We Deserve.
That's a great blog. I read it every week.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy it. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. So, Gene, you've talked about a lot of great stuff. You know, and Drew was joking. I had actually written down, you know, maybe we can get you to run for office if you could make some change out there.
He'll get fired the first week because he'll want to make change.
I've got to have a more spellable last name, I think, if I want to run.
Yeah. Well, I have to see.
I'll give you a Tignanelli if you want to borrow it.
That's right. I said we have to see what you look like. You know, there was a movie Dave out there. Maybe we can get you to be a double for a future president and get you to slide in and solve all the problems. So.
Be the voiceover.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, Gene, as you're talking about all these issues that we have, and you've pointed out some things, but what are some practical things, you know, the government can do? I mean, today, obviously, Janet Yellen came out. Everybody was paying attention to the Fed and what they're doing and that balance sheet. I don't know if you want to, you know, speak to what they've got to do and some of the concerns around that. But, you know, what is it that, you know, we can do on a practical basis? What do you think is realistic that we can expect and try and accomplish here?
So I don't know whether this big issue is solvable without sort of full engagement by a president. And That may be asking a lot. But actually, if you think about the last two presidents, when they decided they really wanted something at the beginning of their term, George W. Bush wanted his tax cut, and President Obama wanted health care for all. I predicted in both cases they were going to get it, because it's hard for a president not to get that first victory and establish his way of doing things. His party will do anything to make it happen. So I think it's possible to get presidential leadership to do it this long run. And my big solutions are pretty big, but they're basically nothing more or nothing simpler than restoring flexibility to the budget. So from the left, I think you've just got to agree that the automatic growth in these programs has to be brought under control. You can vote for it, but don't make it automatic. So Social Security and Medicare is not really an issue for the current elderly. They're not going to get hit much, but if you're middle-aged, you're an average couple, you're supposed to get about $1.33 million in retirement and health benefits vis-a-vis somebody who's 62 or 65 now. Couple is supposed to get about $1 million. So take some of that growth out of there, and then let's decide what we want to do with it for other things. That's what has to be given up on the left. On the right, I think you got to pay our bills as we go along. The notion that a tax cut that's not matched by a spending cut doesn't make sense. I think you've also got to be willing to deal with the automatic growth and all the tax subsidies. I don't know, you know, why that's off the table is beyond me. It's not a conservative agenda to say, as long as we spend through the tax code, it's okay. You know, if we had a subsidy in the tax code, it's okay. We just oppose direct spending. So that's what they've got to give up long run. Now there's some very, substantive procedural issues I think they have to deal with. They like games they can play where they can do something that's called deficit neutral in 10 years and then spend all sorts of money, you know, after 10 years. They've got to come up with rules. That's just no longer allowed. I think the president should have to submit a budget that at least in good times is balanced, not necessarily the first year, but at least balanced, say, over an 8-year cycle or 10-year cycle. And if that's not what he or she submits, then have CBO send it back to him and say Congress doesn't accept this as a valid budget. That's symbolic. It doesn't necessarily have any force of law, but I think it could really make a difference. I think there are a lot of rules that would, require Congress. They could come up with rules if they'd be willing to abide by them that say, you know, if you're going to do some additional spending, you've got to sort of pay for it up front. You can't just shove it all off to the future. And I think when we report on tax cuts, I think we should stop showing the notion that somehow that we cut people's taxes if we haven't sort of reduced spending at the same time, because all we did was shove that debt off to our children. So there's a lot of procedural things that often are quite boring and often hard to talk about. Certainly on in a newspaper column or anything else, it's not about personality. It's setting up a set of rules by which to abide. In some sense, both parties are afraid to give up their attempt to control the future, as I indicated earlier, because they're afraid the other party then wins their agenda. So in some sense, it's almost like tying two Ulysses to the mast together so that the ship can work its way through the shoals. And I think that's where we've really got to go.
Well, now, Gene, we got to take, you know, we went a little longer on the last segment because we were really into some good stuff. So I'm going to have to take a quick break right now. But before we do, I want to set this question up for you so we spend maximum time, the last 10 minutes. We're already toward the end. This is how good this has been. Yeah. So we're in the land. But here's my question. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that a democracy would be the greatest, would be the worst form of government ever, where the majority would enslave the minority, okay? And I don't know if I said that right, but that's the way I've always understood it. We are actually a republic. In other words, politicians are supposed to come in and say, thank you for voting for me, you know who I am, and then go in and implement policy that's in the best interest of the country based on what they think, and it's not supposed to be, you know, a democracy. My question that I'm going to ask you when we come back is, I believe with the transparency of the internet that you're getting more into where politicians are going into office and actually implementing things not in the best interest of the country, but in the best interest of what the people that are watching them on a daily basis are saying, I'm going to vote for you or not vote for you if you don't do this or that. That's what my question is going to be. He's probably sitting on the other end of the line, rolling his eyes, thinking, "Oh man, what am I going to do with that?" Anyway, I got to go to Mark Thibodeau with weather and come right back to Gene Sterley, Dead Men Rolling.
Mm-hmm. Welcome home to the Nationals here in old BC. We're ever true to the red, white, and blue. Washington fights for victory.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Is that really the song of the Nationals, Gene?
I don't really know.
I was going to say, man, I like the Orioles song better anyway. You know, so, Gene, we're down to like the last 6 minutes now, and so I threw out a really crazy question at you because I've always been curious. Is that it seems like the transparency of the internet and the globalization of the world has brought so much information in that people can really influence their politicians much more than they could ever do before. Is that having a major impact?
So it's not just the internet. What almost all politicians tell me, in fact, ones that I highly respect, tell me that it's not all about fundraising. It's all about fundraising all of the time. And even if you're not fundraising for yourself, the leaders.
Now, is this a new phenomenon?
The extent to which this is going on, I think, yes, is a new phenomenon.
Really?
And certainly the extent to which members don't hang around, don't work with each other. When I came to town a few decades ago, you'd be much more likely to have retreats by, say, the Ways and Means Committee or the Senate Finance Committee, where the members on both sides would get together and talk about the major issues they were going to address, whether it was tax reform or health reform or something like that. They don't do that much anymore. They're too busy out there fundraising. Mm-hmm. So, some things have really gotten much worse on the political end, and I have to admit, I haven't solved every issue in this book in terms of how you get the politics to come around. I'll give you another little anecdote here, though. When the Congress was, by agreement, was to set up a bicameral or a joint committee on deficit reduction involving both the House and the Senate, the leaders appointed to that commission people who met one criterion. They had never voted for any major attempt to reduce the deficit, such as supporting a particular provision put forward in a commission by Simpson and Bowles, Erskine Bowles.
Mm-hmm.
The politicians who had voted to support that Simpson-Bowles commission were left off that committee. And that, by the way, included, of all people, the Democratic head of the Senate Budget Committee. So the Democratic head of the Senate Budget Committee was, by his own leaders, left off of a budget committee that was, because he was known as the problem solver that was supposed to solve the problem. So yeah, things have gotten pretty bad politically. You know, we have to get people who really want to be there to solve the problem. They don't have to agree on the solution, but they have to agree that they want to solve it.
Do you think it's possible that a bunch of Democrats and Republicans and all the politicians can get together and totally, completely rethink everything about government, every department, all the tax codes and everything, and not maybe start from scratch, but incredibly just reconfigure for the 21st century? Do you think that's possible or probable?
I think both parties are desperately in search of a 21st century agenda. I think, on the optimistic side, I think we're in a transition period. There's not huge attempts to sort of even add more growth to these health and retirement programs. There's some efforts to sort of cut back on them. They're modest. They're not really working. If you look on the Republican side, they're not arguing for huge tax cuts while the deficit's so low. They're actually moving on, and you'll hear words like opportunity and mobility being floated around, and I argue strongly in this book that that's the type of agenda that we should have for the 21st century, and I think the politicians sort of want to move there. They don't know how to do it because they don't know how to take this straitjacket off themselves. And more discretion, just simply more discretion and flexibility in the budget would get you a lot of what you want, because there would be free resources to spend on new programs or to send back to the taxpayer in the form of tax cuts. And that's what happened early in our history when Hamilton raised taxes to get our budget in order when we finally adopted the Constitution. Remember, the Constitution was largely adopted because our fiscal policy was a, was a total failure.
Yeah.
And then Jefferson comes in later when things are going well, and he cuts taxes.
Right.
So it allowed that flexibility allowed you to have this debate within the context of a thriving and evolving government.
Now, also, sometimes in our past history of our country, a third party has arisen that has had a dramatic impact on our nation. Is there any possibility something like that could happen today?
I think so. You must have been watching the Teddy Roosevelt series, series on PBS these days, because that was part of the story with Teddy running for office again.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's happened several times in our history. And, of course, the Republican Party in the
But can it happen today?
Was a new party.
Can it happen today with the Internet and these guys saying that they're constantly lobbying for raising money and so forth? Could it happen today?
No, leadership is something, I can't predict where leadership's going to come from. It could come from one place or the other. And in the mid-80s, we actually had some attempts at deficit reduction. Interestingly enough, it was led by a group of Senate Republicans, such as Pete Domenici and Bob Dole, who never really got a lot of credit for it, but they really sort of got that house of cards straightened up.
Right.
Nobody predicted that ahead of time, but they rose and decided they would lead. We have leadership often that rises when problems arise. And so I'm sort of a long run optimist that we're going to get this, these problems under control, even if I'm a bit of a short run pessimist.
Well, I think it's a great point that you're making in the book, and it's always the young people that rise up. And one of the problems we have right now is the baby boomers are coming into the senior citizen. They're the highest voting group, people over 60, 65 years of age, and that's where the baby boomers are headed. So if the young people don't rise up between in their 20s and 30s, they could end up being dominated. We only have 1 minute left, Gene.
Well, but real quickly on that, as I pointed out, the current elderly or the elderly point in time are not the issue. It's how do you deal with, what do you want to do with the future growth? The elderly are already home free.
They're the ones that vote.
But they're misled to think that they're under threat because their Social Security benefits going to be sustained. It's the middle-aged people who have to decide, do they want government growth to go for their retirement, or do they want to spend more on fixing those bridges around Wilmington, or do they want to spend more on children's education and do some other things as well?
Yeah, there's a ton of things that we could do that would be extremely beneficial in this country. But anyway, Dead Men Rolling, Gene. It's a great book. I think we could do this week after week if we wanted to, because there's so much to talk about and so much that our country needs the work that people like you are doing. So we honor you for the work you've done in this book and the blog that you have, The Government We Deserve, governmentwedeserve.org, right, Tom?
That's correct.
That's right. Right. Deadmenruling.com or deadmenruling.org. You can read a bunch of reviews there for free if you don't want to buy the book.
Well, we appreciate it, sir. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Drew. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. We have Gene Sterley, Dead Men Ruling. We pray that each of you get this book and read about it. Our country needs you to rise up and change the way this country is being run right now. Anyway, this is Drew Tignanelli, Tom Bombasuto saying God bless.